how do you put together the proper resources as a company to support a community that's been impacted by our derailment?
Yeah, it's incredibly important. And one of the things that I learned early on is that we never know where we're going to have an incident, right? So you only can rely on what you're responsible for, meaning that our hazmat people, our BNSF responders, our service providers, heavy equipment contractors, hazmat contractors, air monitoring contractors, environmental remediation contractors. So we're going to bring in all those resources because you cannot rely on what the community may or may not have. So in one way, it's easy because you don't, if you're not relying on anybody to bring in those specific resources. And we do operate in areas that there is not a fire department.
Welcome to the Environmental Transformation Podcast, where we talk with industry leaders, climate champions, and sustainability professionals who are making an impact in their businesses today. Each leader is solving complex challenges and providing solutions within their respective areas of expertise. And here's our host, Sean Grady.
Hello, ET Nation. It's time to spread the word about this podcast. If you're just tuning in for the first time, well, welcome. We are honored to have you here with us. Please take a moment and subscribe to the podcast and leave a review about this episode. If you are a longtime listener, well, thank you. If you haven't gone to my website lately, please sign up for our newsletter, blog posts, and email announcements, and do it now. Go to www.seankgrady.com. That's www.seankgrady.com. And become a member of the ET Nation today. We look forward to having you join us.
Welcome to the Environmental Transformation Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Grady, and today's guest is Pat Brady. Pat is BNSF Railroad's General Director of Hazardous Materials Safety, and he's located in Fort Worth, Texas. Pat started with the Burlington Northern Railroad in 1991 and as a corporate industrial hygienist, so he's a CIH. Well, that's good to know. He also became the Assistant Director of Hazardous Materials Safety in 1992, and upon BN's merger with the Santa Fe, in 1996, Pat became the manager of hazardous material field operations and emergency response. Pat, welcome to the show and glad to have you on.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. So we're here today in Dallas at the inaugural Rail Thought Leadership Summit for all the various hazmat responders and class one railroads and EMS and LAPC, you know, people in the industry here to really kind of converge and talk about what are some of the challenges that we're facing with preparedness and readiness of the response community. Tell us a little bit about your job and how you support and you know, interact with the responders.
Yeah, 100%. As a general director of hazardous material safety for BNSF Railroad, my responsibility, my team's responsibility is to prepare for and respond to all spills and those that include hazardous materials. And so that is the pre-planning aspects of it, to comply with all local, state, and federal agency regulations on spill planning, and then help communities prepare for an emergency response, doing community training with first responders, exercises, that type of thing. And then when we do have an incident, that we mobilize there along with our service providers to respond safely and effectively to get the community back to where they were pre-incident and get the railroad back running.
That's great. I mean, that sounds like a big task when you think about it. And you probably have a team of people helping you do it, right?
Yeah, we do. And it is a big task. We operate in 28 states and 3 Canadian provinces. We're over 32,500 miles in length.
Wow.
About 1.2 million shipments of hazardous material annually. So it is a big task, but we have a very dedicated team within BNSF that does that. We also have team BNSF that works very hard to prevent incidents from occurring. But incidents do occur, and we need to be prepared to be able to respond again safely and effectively.
Absolutely. you know, some of the conversations at the conference here, we were talking about, well, what are some of the biggest challenges you see or that you face in regard to response readiness in the hazmat community?
Yeah. Well, so when you look at, even though you, when you read the news, maybe monthly, you'll see that there has been a train derailment. Sometimes they have a release of hazardous materials, but it is a very low frequency, but a potential high consequence incident. And so when you're trying to train first responders, they have a lot of other responsibilities, responsibilities, that type of thing. And there's a lot of, it probably will never happen here, so let's worry about the things that always happen here.
Right.
And unfortunately, sometimes they don't think about the potential for a rail incident until you have an emergency. And then my team and I have to go in and really establish those relationships during the kind of the heat of the fire to be able to work with those first responders to get things mitigated safely.
You know, as a hazmat employer, what are some of the challenges in developing a systematic program to provide the initial and the reoccurring hazmat training to employees that, you know, that you can document in a proper manner? I mean, like that seems to be probably a pretty challenging prospect at times.
It is challenging, but I think that when I compare when I started 30 something years ago, it's a lot easier now, you know, so you have learning management systems, web-based training that you can assign that information to them. Given the technology that we have today, it doesn't cost as much as it used to be able to build these web-based training. You don't necessarily have to have instructors going out and doing instructor-led training. So technology has really helped us.
Oh, yeah.
But with that, you know, the how we train adult learners now is a lot different than, and we always have to be able to pivot as time changes. And, you know, when we look at training for first responders, we look at the same thing that we do instructor-led classes, the old school way, but we also offer web-based training and utilizing, like, understanding that the younger first responders probably are into video gaming. So we're looking at and develop some training on virtual reality that it is more like a video game. So unfortunate consequence of that is the older responders take that and they're not real happy.
But
the younger ones like it. So we're always trying to find newer and better ways.
Well, that's really interesting because I'm a little aware of some of the virtual reality apps that your training modules that you've put together. What was the impetus, you know, that you guys came to a decision that, okay, we want to be one of the leaders in the class one railroad group industry to really start to provide this type of cutting edge training? I mean, was it the fact that you were having difficulties in attracting the younger generation to the table?
We're always, you know, I kind of look at sometimes my job as to being a bit of a salesperson, right? So you cast a very wide net and hopefully you have a lot of fish in your basket at the end of the day. And we were looking to, one, how can we provide training that will be retained by the first responder? And then hopefully create some buzz of one responder takes it and go, it was actually kind of fun to take.
Yeah.
And then so more responders will take it. So just getting enough people to hear the word about how to safely respond to these incidents and try to get that information out to them. So we still do instructor-led classes. We still do the old PowerPoint kind of web-based training, but we are developing more virtual reality type training.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Environmental Transformation Podcast. We'll be right back after this message. This episode is sponsored by Zappa Stewart, the leading provider of superabsorbent polymer technology in the power, dredging, oil and gas, and remediation sectors for over 20 years. When a reliable, fast, and cost-effective liquid waste solidification solution is needed, customers count on the ZappaZorb brand of SAPs and Zappa Stewart's technical expertise to ensure a smooth and successful project. When liquid waste needs to be out of sight and out of mind, solidify with ZappaZorb SAPs. To learn more about Zappa Stewart and the superabsorbent polymers they offer, visit their website at www.chasecorp.com/Zappa-Stewart. You know, one of the takeaways I've learned through the breakout sessions was that there's a lot of curriculum out there, mm-hmm. and everyone has their own little version of the curriculum. Is there any interest potentially in having a national kind of standardized curriculum for the railroad so that you get like that initial awareness training is consistent, and maybe you can actually maybe standardize it so that everyone's singing off the same sheet of music?
Yeah. And I don't think it would be too difficult to do that. You know, we co-teach with other railroads from time to time. Mm-hmm. And when we look at our program versus, let's say, the Union Pacific's program, the information is the same. And even the slides themselves in a PowerPoint presentation are virtually the same. So it would not take that much to combine all of that. We have different nomenclature, but it's kind of minutia, probably for the first responders. Yeah. It's very important to us, but I think we could come to a common goal of being able to do that without a lot of effort.
That would be great. I mean, it would be akin to, say, developing a credential like the CIH credential, mm-hmm. the CHMM credential. Like the CHMM largely covers a lot of the hazmat response requirements, except it doesn't go in far enough detail into the specific railroad aspects of what needs to be learned, right?
Agreed.
So it meets maybe 50%, but it doesn't get the rest of it. And I'm thinking, wow, could there be a body that really kind of collaboratively works together to say, look, here's the blueprint to maybe bridge the gap here. And then you have a credential.
Yeah, I don't think that would be that difficult. And a lot of our hazmat managers are CHMMs. Mm. There's other certifications that they have, but I do think the CHMM is probably the closest connection to what we do.
Yeah, I think so. And at least based on what I've seen too. And it could be another way also to help provide that little carrot for your employees or responders. Like, hey, if you have this credential, there's a little monetary reward for someone who gets that level of awareness training or whatnot, because they have to maintain it like well do, yeah. right? So there's a little sustainability built into it as well from staff and employee retention. But I think also, would it provide you another level of, say, a peace of mind knowing when someone shows up at the site and they're this credential person, they already know how to deal with certain levels of what they're coming to do?
Yeah, I do think that, and that's the reason why I put my two certifications, CIH and CSP, on my business card. That I'm, when you hand that business card to somebody, I just want them to have kind of a sense that I know what I'm doing. And same thing when we're interviewing new hazmat managers, potential hazmat managers. Mm-hmm. When I see that CHMM certification, it is something that I know that there's a rigor that they went through,
yeah.
and there is annual training that they're required to do. So it is, all those certifications are beneficial.
That's excellent. Yeah. When one of the other themes I've listened to is this whole stakeholder engagement and the challenges, or maybe the connecting of the dots, so to speak, of the various stakeholders that need to be involved, mm-hmm. with a response that when it does occur. Talk a little bit about some of the challenges and or maybe some of the things you're putting in place or programs that, you know, are helping you, you know, ensure that the right people are there.
Yeah. And we talked about that earlier, that community responders really have a lot of different tasks that they need to do. And hazmat is just one of them. And then railroad hazmat is a subsection of that. And so even though we spent a lot of resources to try to train first responders, we train about 8,000 to 9,000 first responders every year, given our different tools. And some of the frustration is that you'll have a class set up for 20 and you get 10 people. And then they come back and they go, man, that was really great. Can you come back and get the rest of the 10? And there's hundreds of other communities that we have to do that in. And that does get a bit frustrating, though I understand the challenges, especially in the rural areas.
Yeah.
On volunteerism is not what it used to be.
Oh, yeah.
And volunteer fire chiefs will tell us that we have 100 people on our volunteer fire department, but typically only 10 or 20 show up for monthly training. So it is a struggle, not only for us, but for them.
Yeah, I can imagine. When you think about some safety training opportunities, one of the things I know that seems to be a hot, interesting way of training is like the safety trains. Mm-hmm. How often are you involved with offering a safety train type demonstration with locals?
We actually have two safety trains, one in the east and one in the western part of our system. It got a box car with stadium seating. It seats about 32 people. And then we have a training tank car, both in the east and the west. And then each one of our response managers and directors have training trailers that have all the valves and fittings that you would see. Uh-huh. And one of the things that is important is that a lot of the stuff that we show them on tank car construction, on how the valves work, is stuff that they're incredibly interested in, but it's not something that they particularly need. Yeah. Right. So All the stuff that they 100% need is how to read a consist or a train list, mm-hmm. understanding what the DOT proper shipping description is. How do you identify the cars that are derailed in the train through the car initial car numbers? How to take that DOT description and do a size up? What was priority? What's something that we don't really worry about? What's the hazards associated with that? And then how do you roll that into a unified incident command and set up like an ICS 201 initial incident action for that? But typically the responders need that, but don't want that per se.
Yeah.
They want to look at, they want to go through a locomotive and understand, you know, how many horsepower it is and that it's a diesel electric locomotive and how many gallons of fuel, which is important, but not nearly important as that first part. So, You know, our training program is typically 3 to 4 hours, mm-hmm. but really the important part is the first, call it 45 to 60 minutes of the incident of the training. So the concern is always if, as an adult learner, if you're only going to retain 10% of what you're taught, I don't need them to understand that there's 6,000 gallons of diesel fuel in a mm-hmm. locomotive. I need them to understand how to read a train list and how to size up an incident from that train list.
How important for you is the stakeholder engagement support of a community? I'm sure it's very important to you, but I mean, how do you put together the proper resources as a company to support a community that's been impacted by our derailment?
Yeah, it's incredibly important. And one of the things that I learned early on is that we never know where we're going to have an incident,
yeah,
right? So you only can rely on what you're responsible for, meaning that our hazmat people, our BNSF responders, our service providers, heavy equipment contractors, hazmat contractors, air monitoring contractors, environmental remediation contractors. So we're going to bring in all those resources because you cannot rely on what the community may or may not have. So in one way, it's easy mm-hmm. because you don't, if you're not relying on anybody to bring in those specific resources. And we do operate in areas that there is not a fire department. In very rural areas of Wyoming, right. North Dakota, there is not even a fire department. So one of the biggest needs is that we need to be able to go into, whether it's a large community or a small community, and pull into a unified incident command and work with the community to mitigate the incident. It can't just be the railroad.
Yeah.
That doesn't work well. We need the community members involved in there.
Do you typically have like a designated point person that is like the community mouthpiece liaison for you guys in the event? You know, like I'm sure the initial hazmat responder, he's busy dealing with the issue. And then you've got a community person that's really talking to the local LAPCs or the local affected mayors or town people.
And we have both.
Okay.
Right. So we have an incident management team that would come in. So our governmental relations and our public relations people, they're really dealing with the government and the press. Mm-hmm. And then typically me or one of my directors would be the incident commander for BNSF.
Yep.
And we're liaisoning or in a unified command with the fire chief or state police or whoever the agency having jurisdiction has said who's in charge of the incident. And then then it flows from there.
Gotcha. So like for on your side, you show up as the incident commander for BNSF, and then you probably are also bringing in some of your other hazmat managers to come support you in the actual response activities, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I got to be honest with you. Typically, years ago, if you wanted to know where I was, probably closest to the tank car that was leaking.
Yeah.
You know, I have had to pivot over the last couple of years and be more in an incident command role than a boots on the ground responder, which
sure.
has been extremely difficult for me, as my guys will tell you.
You want to be in the
exactly
in the trenches,
but there is a need to maintain that incident command structure.
Oh, well, yeah. And then having an expert that has been through enough of these types of situations to know how to make the calls and call in the resources. Mm-hmm.
ET Nation, thanks for tuning in. We'll be right back after this message. Today's episode is sponsored by Cascade Environmental, the only field services contractor with the experts and equipment to support you from project conception to completion. In addition to the drilling and site characterization services that Cascade is known for, they also offer turnkey in-situ remediation services that include a line of injectable amendments that target tough contaminants like DNAPL, chlorinated solvents, TPH, PEAHs, and PCBs. To learn more about their in-situ remediation services and their line of injectable chemistries, check out their website at www.cascade-env.com/remediation. Contact Cascade to help you start cleaning up your site today.
When we talk about resources, if you could talk a little bit about maybe the vetting process BNSF goes through in securing and locking up these critical relationships with your emergency response contractors, your consultants, your air monitoring people, all these other resources that come immediately to a response. What's that process look like for you?
Yeah, and we have different levels of on the hazmat side, different levels of responders. So we have our level one responders that can respond to anything from a diesel fuel release to a breach chlorine car. So mm-hmm. they can do everything. And then our level three contractors are probably just kind of diesel fuel cleanup
yep.
type of contractors. However, in a large incident, we're using all three levels, right? So typically those very specialized contractors are probably quite a distance away from where you have the incident. So it's going to take them a while to fly in and get there.
Yep.
So we'll use that first layer along with our group of about 70 BNSF hazmat responders that are technician level that are additional duty. They get in there and they're first layer. So it's kind of a force multiplier mm-hmm. of your level three contractors and your hazmat responders going in there. And then the second tier and the third tier come in.
Yeah, no, that whole layering process is probably really key to help sustaining and maintaining a good response. And then you get your experts coming in. That's really good. One of the things that always is interesting is as you respond and now the project is you've dealt with it. Talk a little bit about how you transition maybe from the response to now it's a project or a cleanup scenario because the emergency is kind of taking care of now.
Yeah. And that's sometimes negotiated with the regulatory agencies, whether you turn from an emergency phase to a remediation phase. And sometimes that is not 100% parallel to when my group phases out and our remediation team comes in. Mm-hmm. And that's also layered. So we're doing emergency response activities at the same time that they're doing remediation activities.
Yeah.
Typically, we take care of the initial spill, transfer of commodities, putting fires out, that type of thing, removal of cars, to give them a clean slate to be able to start doing dig and haul operations and that type of thing. So it's a coordinated effort through the Unified Incident Command.
When you're dealing with the community, is there anything that's been kind of like, oh, wow, you know, just in past experience, like, oh, you know what? This was a learning we took away that we didn't really think about. And now it's like, okay, this, we do better now. Is there anything like that?
100%. And when I look through my career and how I would do things, you know, 25 years ago, it's not going to work today.
Yeah.
And the miracle of the internet is one of those things that whenever now that you have a derailment and the name of the chemicals in the press,
yeah,
you got to anticipate everybody's going to Google that. And,
yeah.
and some of the information that you provide to the press to get to the public is based on on their Google searches.
Yeah.
And so you need to anticipate some of those issues and answer those questions, because sooner or later, the public are going to ask.
It's going to start becoming a social media thing.
Exactly. Too, right? Well, also, we're always learning. So when we started moving unit trains of flammable liquids, crude oil or ethanol, we had to develop and build industrial firefighting trailers, because it was clear that depending on where the incident was and again, not having to rely directly on what the fire department will have, we just needed to have resources that were available. So you're continuing to pivot as changes in the public are made, and also on our response capabilities.
As we kind of bring this back to the summit that we're here today, what are some of the outcomes or what you would view as successes? What's your takeaways from the conference here?
I think the successes is that we have people from all walks of life in the emergency response realm, from fire departments to emergency managers to mayors and that type of thing. And ultimately, we all have the same goal. So we talk about our priorities in an ICS 201, and we all have the same priorities. Mm-hmm. And we all understand that we need to do pre-planning and training in advance of an incident. So the good news is we all know what the right thing to do is. We just need to figure out what's the best way of doing that.
Yeah, I think another kind of takeaway I've seen is just connecting dots, right? Connecting and communicating with the right stakeholders, it mm-hmm. seems to be. And it's really great and encouraging to see all these thought leaders come to this conference and really focus on solving these gaps or issues that have been identified, especially in this report that Skip Elliott and team put together, which I thought was very insightful. It asked a lot of really good questions that made you thought provoking. And I think it's generated some additional questions as well. But I think it's doing its job. With FEMSA and Bill Schoonover and those guys coming, this really are putting some regulatory and federal support behind this whole effort too.
Yeah, 100%. The more momentum we can get from this summit, I think we can take that and back into the public and train more first responders and making sure that they're prepared.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I'm really glad, Pat, that you came to do this interview with us. The listeners, I'm sure, who track on this platform, they're environmental professionals. This is what they do for a living as well. And they may be maybe an EHS person, or they may be a hazmat responder, and or they may be just a regulator, but they're getting a perspective of the industry from this platform. And thank you for coming on the show and sharing a little bit about what BNSF's doing and what we're doing here at the Rail Summit.
Yep. I appreciate you having me.
Thank you.
I want to thank our guest, Pat Brady, for coming on to the show today. If you want to learn more about Pat and the work he's doing at BNSF, check out their website at www.bnsf.com. We'll also put a link to Pat's contact information on my website. To listen to future Environmental Transformation podcasts, you can check us out on all the major podcast networks or from my website at www.seankgrady.com. And remember, don't forget to follow us and please write a review about this episode. Also, if you're watching on YouTube, please subscribe to the channel. Well, thanks for listening, and until next time, make a positive impact in someone's life today.